Okay, so my presentation is going to consist of two parts.
Can you use
this thing?
So we won't be blocking.
Oh yeah, right. Okay. So the first part is some general thoughts on relationship between exactly solvable models and quantum gases, and I'm going to do that on a blackboard because I don't want any trace of it. But since I'm recorded, I wouldn't succeed. And the second part is a more formal account of what we do with Marvin and Vanya, and also Vanya's colleague.
Yeah, let me just say that Max, you kindly put my name on there because we have a joint grant. But as far as this fringe degradation business, it's almost gone.
Well, it is so much. I mean, it's hard to tell what comes from the phone calls every other day, and what comes from the actual. I mean, sitting down and writing down the formulas is not the whole story. So in any case, let me get to the less formal part, which is going to be on the blackboard. And I have one small sheet can I raise the screen somehow? Ah, okay, nice. Low tech. And I should say right away that you needn't think that I'm trying to play a role of a meter or something. It looks general, but it's not as general as it might seem. So I'm going to talk about the integrable systems. So versus quantum gases. Well, basically, in every area of physics, we have four approaches, and it's in experimental, exactly solvable. Exactly solvable, numerical, and what is traditionally called physics, the qualitative slash analytical. No, that's what I do. All right, if you want to include it, please. But qualitative. Right, and there is lots. There is lots of connections at the level of results, right? When we get experimental results, we match them with our curves, but we don't really know much, or we don't really care much, or we learn little from how the actual experiment is done. It changes nothing in your worldview if you know how the multi-channel plate works, or how much vacuum you need. So lots of connections over there. But there's usually a little connection at the level of ideas, with some very interesting exceptions. So I can give an example from quantum optics, where in quantum optics the idea of stochastic wave functions, which was invented purely as a numerical method, really changed our way of how we look at interaction of a small quantum system interacting with a reservoir. I mean, now if you talk to quantum mechanicians, they think in terms of quantum jumps. They think in terms of wave function propagating via some Langevin equation, and so on and so forth. So that's an example of a connection I have in mind, and what I'm going to illustrate that probably we already have, or at least we might have in the future, the same level, the same degree of exchange of ideas at the level of the actual work. Again, not at the level of the results, but at the level of ideas between exactly solved models and which is relatively new for at least for atomic physicists. I mean, in atomic physics we had a few exactly solvable models, but there were never many bodies. So it was very rare. Now we have really an exposure to it. Okay, so the first important thing is that I think if you really analyze a system which is exactly solvable, you are somehow intuitively not pushed, but you are inspired to use and jump back and forth between the first quantization and the second quantization. So which is usually we think about many body systems in terms of the second quantization. So in the first quantization, many things become transparent. And by the way, the Betansatz itself. So the way someone with my background will look at the Betansatz is from the point of view of, so usually you have n particles, say in one dimension, interacting with quantum interactions. But what could be useful is to replace so n particles in 1D by a single particle in n dimensions. And let's see what happens for two particles. So say that's the coordinate of the first one, that's the coordinate of the second. So this two-dimensional particle moves according to the wave equation, okay? And in here, along the line corresponding to the interactions, we have nothing else but a thin dielectric plate. And what turns out is that for this particular geometry, you can apply, the geometric optics rigorously applies. So you start from rays, okay, and each ray corresponds, a ray corresponds to a state, to plane wave with a fixed set of momenta. Okay, and then you can think about solving this problem by method of images. So you reflect with respect to this one, you get another k vector which is just a permutation of the k vectors, and so on and so forth. So what's interesting is that the problems of this kind indeed appear in electrodynamics, meaning that if you have a cavity, or in this case it's a semi-cavity, if you have a cavity with certain geometry of the walls in three dimensions, two dimensions, so on and so forth, independent on the property of the walls, but dependent on the geometry of the walls, the problem is either integral via geometric optics or it isn't. And I'm pretty much confident in that, because I've spent a year of my life in designing cavities for particle accelerators. So it was my bachelor project. So I stress the point that integrability in this case is perhaps a purely geometrical effect. Geometrical meaning that it depends on the geometry of the non-trivial lines like dielectric plates, and it does not depend on the actual behavior of this line. So the way to spoil integrability is now for these two particles. So for these two particles, I add a stationary delta potential. So a stationary delta potential. So what would it? It would be just Lieb-Linear gas with an impurity. So this delta potential, it corresponds to a cross in this two-dimensional space. And from this cavity analysis, we know that if so now the geometry of the singular lines is different. Now we have 45 degrees between those, and this problem is no longer solvable via method of images, meaning that this problem is no longer solvable as a superposition of states with a finite set of momenta. So what you get there is near field effects. So you get some spherical waves propagating from the center, meaning that the spectrum of momenta is continuous. And this problem is solved in Morse Feshbach, right? There's no C here. Yeah, okay. Morse Feshbach. So that's
what exactly problem was solved in Morse and Feshbach?
Exactly this one. Two particles plus a delta potential. Okay. Yeah.
The particles are
interacting. Yeah, and you might think that yes, with multiple reflections we get eight sets of the k vectors, and so somehow you might think that's sufficient, but it is not. And my conjecture is that it doesn't matter whether you put here infinite strong interactions or finite interactions. It doesn't matter what the strengths of interactions are here. That's pure geometry that defines integrability, non-integrability, and that's a kind of a link I'm talking about. So another thing, again about the first quantization.
Does that mean the Morse-Feshbach solution is not quote unquote integrable?
Is not quote unquote. It is not okay. It is not scalable.
Exact solution, but it's not integrable in some sense.
Okay, it's an exact solution, but it is not scalable to many particles.
Is that one? Oh, I see. That's
yeah.
The
No. Integrability in the Betanzat sense would mean that your many-body wave function z1, zn in any sector is expressible as a linear superposition of the states, a linear superposition of the plane waves, exponent of I sum over I k I. Zi, okay, and here you'll have a permutation. Okay, so here you'll have a permutation. So in every sector, you have a set of exactly n momenta, and the only difference between the different terms is permutations of those momenta, and this Morse Feshbach problem is not better and that's integrable even at the two-body level that puts little face to the scalability of the whole thing. Okay, so another thing. So another thing which somehow stems from the which can be easily seen in the first quantization, but is very I wouldn't really know how to think about it in second quantization is the high momentum asymptotics of the momentum distribution. Momenta. So I'll spend some time on that in my formal talk, but what happens is that the singularities in the many-body wave function, so we have cusp-like singularities, lead to the 1 over k to the 4 tails in the momentum distribution as k goes to infinity, and you analyze that at the first quantized level. You look at the singularity, you fully transform it, and you get that. So what's more is that this result stands survives for in any dimension, in two dimension and in three dimensions. So this scaling. So to some extent it bounces back. So you start from an integrable system and analyze the singularities, and then realize that you don't really need integrability. I mean, the only thing you need is a singular type of interaction. Delta is a delta-like interaction, And
that comes out of the Bobrilov theory as well.
Oh yes, certainly. But this statement goes for any strengths of interactions.
Well, I guess it's two comments. One is that in one D system, then one generally interested in long wavelength. The question is that, well, maybe it's, but there's a separate, maybe you address those issues. Why is the high momentum one interesting?
Okay.
The second one is that, isn't this one of the K4? Again, the question whether how many body each is this? Because I saw it has seen a high momentum. Again, I can talk about two party scattering. And then based on the free particle, which is k squared, xi k equals to e.
Even
momentum distribution, one of the k squared essentially from the Schrödinger equation, from the single particle Schrödinger equation.
From the single particle, you won't get it. From two particles, yes.
Two particles.
Yes.
Very high momentum scattering.
Yes, exactly. It's not quite many bodies. I agree.
Yes.
I mean, the important point is having cusp, but in the integrable case, we can go, we can get all the prefactors, and in fact, then get the prefactors in front of this law. And now explaining why this high momenta are important. So far, I can say that they're important from the experimental point of view, because the high momentum tails of the momentum distribution, they are not sensitive to very many things. I mean, they're not sensitive to the residual. You usually observe them in the expansion, so they're not sensitive to the residual mean field, because usually we work with many needles, and when we open these needles, there's still a Bodenstein cloud. And it pushes the particles away. They are less sensitive to the finite temperature. And also if you analyze the data, in order to get a prefactor, you just compute the momenta of the momentum distribution, mean k squared, mean k four, mean k three, and so on and so forth. I mean it's so the reason is purely technical, and of course high momentum distribution is far less universal as compared to the low momentum distribution.
I mean, I agree with everything you say. I think it would be also important to distinguish phenomena that are really correlated in nature, and also where the things are essentially free body in nature.
What is really many body is what really comes from the strong correlations is a large value of this prefactor.
Right, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So the larger is the prefactor, the more correlated.
K4,
yeah, it's not K4. No, K4 is two body. Yes. K4 is two body.
Important in the fact that at least in the three dimensions that you get a finite depletion, because you get an integral of d squared, which is basically the momentum density. And so you get a k squared dk, and if this weren't one k fourth, you wouldn't get a convergent depletion.
Yeah.
At large, because otherwise the integral would diverge, and you'd have to have laws and things like that. A horrible thing.
In 1D you get a divergent depletion if you don't do the thing right. I mean, Ivan Kastan does more rigorous treatment, and he doesn't get this divergence. And one more comment: in 3D, the mean kinetic energy would diverge with these tails,
and the meaning.
For me it's much simpler than that. So in order to measure the momentum distribution, you have to release. You have to set to zero your interactions first, and when you do that, so you let's imagine that we work with finite range potentials which are approximately delta function. So you move the bottom of the potential up, and this pumps an infinite energy to the system. So this one over k with this divergence is in fact it stems from the fact that within the interaction potential the wave function oscillates widely, and if you have interactions, this high kinetic energy is compensated by interactions. But when you want to measure your momentum distribution, you have to remove the interactions first, and that releases this huge kinetic energy on top of the potential. So then Oh yes, okay, so there is one more thing I probably, okay, I'll probably omit. Oh, all right, okay, so now, so another point I would like to make is that we could, we could arrogantly say that whatever scaling laws follow from exactly solvable models, we could estimate them anyways. And here is a challenge. So for small k, Tom's Girard Gaz. So in the momentum distribution, you get 1 over square root of k behavior. Try to get it on qualitative grounds. I couldn't. So it's not. So integral systems are not only good for. Do you know the answer?
Probably, but I go.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Can you?
This is a Lagrangian thing here. Yeah. This is just. Why not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes, I know, but imagine we didn't know the equation of state. So of course, right? Okay, so what we'll get is the Haldane's exponent here.
Yeah.
But you get it from the equation of state. You need to know the speed of sound.
Okay.
But imagine you didn't know the equation of state, and the only thing you knew is. Yes, it's a hardcore interactions. I mean, would you be able to guess this one, one over square root of k?
Yeah, the answer you're dealing with the Tom Girardo gas, so you know the equation of state immediately.
But imagine we didn't.
Well, suppose you say, well, in general, I have some interaction. I don't know.
I mean, this square root is too simple, and one might think that one could get this scaling even without knowing the exact solution, as we do for 1 over k to the 4, right? So we don't need to know the exact solution to get this scaling, right? But here it seems like the knowledge of the exact solution is really important.
Well, for the wave function, I guess you can, there's a kind of Jastrow-like form low frequency.
And even from the wave function, I mean, can you really, if I indeed have the wave function.
It's probably the wave function, not a property of the equation of state.
Okay. And
if you look at the Jastrow, if you write the wave function in Jastrow form, it's actually the long distance behavior of the Jastrow factor that allows you to read on.
And can you see it from here?
Probably, yeah. It will be from, yeah.
I honestly tried, and
yeah, it will be from the long distance behavior.
Oh yes, but this long distance behavior, you have to compute n minus one integrals.
Right, exponential with some of ij log sign.
But it does not come out immediately.
It doesn't come. I know. If I perform n minus one integrations, I will get the square root. But is there any way to see? Right. Okay.
Actually, I have a comment. The form like that, you can never see the ground state properties from the form like that, because you can imagine one and the same many body wave function which will describe a liquid and a solid simultaneously. You will just fine tune some parameter in the positive definite wave function that is just type on that, and the ground state will be changed. That will be a ground phase transition from solid to liquid. So maybe we cannot just.
No, it's a flaw from the long. If you write that as exponential of some of I or S and J of log of sine, it's actually the behavior of the Jastrow
factor. You can see it in the Coulomb gas.
Yeah.
Ah.
You could map. Yeah, you see to the long because the basically RPA fluctuations are what are really encoding
yeah.
the Jastrow.
All right. Okay.
That's actually how you know about the.
So I will get a one-dimensional Coulomb gas with logarithmic interactions.
Exactly.
Okay, and then I do statics with it.
That reads off the value of A.
Okay.
Will it be the microscopic wave function or some effective?
Well, if you're given a wave function and you ask what
it's a fine undergraduate project.
He's asking, given a wave function, what is it?
Yes.
This is a zero equal time correlation function. It's a property of the wave function. So you can read it. Given the wave function, you can read it.
I can read off from Coulomb gas.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay. And the very last issue before I pass to the transparencies.
Because the other one would be sine. If you take the back to a power law, which is actually the exact wave function for the Calogero model.
Yep.
But again, you can see that. Yeah. It's read off
okay.
Exponents of the law.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, the Gauss law wouldn't directly apply, right? Because log is not a good solution of the Poisson equation in one D. But all right, okay. Thanks. Yeah, I know what I give for the next undergraduate project. This thing. All right. Okay. Okay. The very last. The very last issue is which is raised by, in fact, by Barry McCoy at ITP Stony Brook, which is there is a certain degree of imparity between finite and infinite systems. So for the finite. For the finite problems, the integrable models they solve as a seed to treat approximately weakly perturbed non-integral models via the Kolmogorov-Arnold-Moder theory, and we don't as a theorem, and we don't have that for infinite systems. So this Leibniz-Jur gas is somehow an isolated point. We don't even try to spoil the integrability, give some finite range to the interparticle interactions and deduce something about the big system. And in fact, the McCoy's conjecture is that the Kolmogorov-Arnold-Moser theorem is not valid in the thermodynamic limit, which is okay. So one should prove it, but
I don't understand the KM theory.
It's a classical thing. It doesn't matter when you look at it at the level of.
Is there a quantum analog of the KM theorem, or what? I don't quite understand what you're talking about.
Or
are you saying that I somehow map the Coulomb system in some integral function form so that I can have define classical orbits? Suppose I do a finite temperature in a partition function, then I can define classical orbits. And
yes.
And I can talk about the KM theorem on that structure.
On that structure, yes.
Okay, continue.
Well, and yes, okay. So, all right. And the conjecture is that at least for classical systems, as you go to the thermodynamic limit, even a small non-integral perturbation of the system brings you very, very far away from the original integrable trajectories. And in this respect, the infinite integral systems are less useful than finite, so they can't really serve as a guide or as a seed, or something like that. And that's in fact a big
question.
Let's
mix. I don't know what they're Coy's, or, I mean, let's be very precise. I mean, the KM's theorem is a theorem about the stability of
classical systems,
or classical orbits, and whether the torus will break up into smaller.
Yes.
Cycles. Now the question is that in what sense that we have any of those things in the quantum systems, but and how. And what's the point you're trying to make then? That are you saying that the integrable system that we have would not be of any use as a starting point for any quantum?
For example, if you try to do the perturbation theory on you start from from pairwise interactions that lead to an exactly integrable system, and then change them to a finite range, and you consider the difference between this and that as a perturbation. So the conjecture is that the
let me be very precise. Suppose I want to calculate along the correlation functions of that bomb at very low energy, but not at high energy. Then the question is that, do I have any business to use that the other function to estimate? And I would be very well surprised that they have no use at all.
Yeah. Well, at low energy, yes, low energies.
Well, let's see. The integrable system has a finite number of particles that have a finite order n constants of the motion, right?
Yes.
So I guess if you switch on a very a weak perturbation on the scale of n, or 1 over n or something, then there will be some residual effect of those equations of the motion, those constants of motion.
Well, it also depends on how this perturbation, what momentum dimension affects all the high momentum, on a high momentum scale, definitely having a low momentum scale, then I don't see why.
Well, in the okay, I know for sure what the conjecture is in the classical case. So in the classical case, the statement would be that if you have an infinite system, and you perturb it from integrable to non-integrable, it would immediately chaotize. It will immediately chaotize everywhere. So you won't have this persisting KM tori, but it will chaotize immediately.
But for a finite system.
For a finite system, yes.
Same thing here. There's this level repulsion issue that when you've got infinite.
Yeah.
The levels repel each other. Don't repel each other when you have a infinite or order n set of constants of motion, because they'll have different values of that. And you see a different statistics if you get a crossover from Poisson to one of the matrix ensemble cases, and switch on. So presumably you can switch on a weak perturbation.
Yes.
Compared to the scale of the energy.
Yes.
Level splitting, so you will still see the you'll see the crossover.
Yeah.
You'll have a crossover eventually between Poisson and
For finite systems, what will happen is that true crossings will become avoided crossings, but still invisible. And for an infinite system, the statistics would probably become immediately a Poisson one.
If you put a twisted boundary condition on this thing and scan it through, you'll find a whole lot of levels that go through crossings which can occur as I fiddle around with the boundary condition twist on the integrable system, and those will get rounded off when you switch on the.
What's the conjecture to my question? Suppose I want to calculate the correlation function of this at one. If this function is very weak, are you saying that I have no business of using the all the other functions?
Long range. In the long range, I think you can use it.
No,
you would be rather. I think what it could affect. For example, you are interested in the dynamics of thermalization, which is.
I can sort of imagine certain energy scale. If you have energy scale to talk about, and then we call it to the perturbation. Anyway, so just simple question. Why
don't you continue? Well, I'm almost done with this part.
You get some kind of
through the weight, which is
which
will become smeared.
I guess I'm slightly struck by the philosophical. Since we are coming to the philosophical or general dress question, I don't want to have a general idea that once you turn on anything and then I don't have any, I mean, if unlike in classical things that everything just get completely wiped out. If that is the case, then what is the fate of there are entirely different text points, etc.
It's the lifetime, if you've got an infinite, you've got all these extra constants of motion for the integral case, then will be they will each no longer, and they will presumably correspond to some local, quasi-local conservation laws. Once you switch on the perturbation, they'll get to the lifetime. There must be some crossover lifetime where they're affecting them.
Well, even though I mean, the way I see that if a system is exactly integrable, so then you have this infinite set of integrals of motion, and each of them is rigorously conserved, right? So then if when you spoil it, they're no longer conserved. But if there is a finite number of them, then for some time you can say that they're approximately conserved. But if there is an infinite number and the dynamics of non-conservation of these integrals of motion becomes more and more rapid as you go for higher and higher integrals of motion, so what you get in the end is an almost immediate chaotization, and that happens with the classical nonlinear Schrödinger equation as well. As far as I know, I mean, it is formally integrable, but you can always you can choose a set of initial conditions such that the motion is almost chaotic. I mean, if you have too many integrals of motion, it is almost a chaos. And
there's a qualitative consequence of integrability.
Oh, yes, please.
For example, you know such a phenomenon as Kolmogorov cascade?
Yep.
In nonlinear Schrödinger equation, there is no Kolmogorov cascade. The chaos is a trivial in nonlinear Schrödinger. It's equivalent to a linear system, basically. You cannot have a Kolmogorov cascade. But once you add something, which removes integrability, you immediately get Kolmogorov cascade, because Kolmogorov cascade is prohibited only by the conservation, by extra integrals of motion. Once you destroy this conservation, you immediately get qualitatively new phenomenon, Kolmogorov cascade.
Absolutely.
And it is observable.
It's a quantitative function, not qualitative.
That's
you immediately get new quality.
Well, they still decay, and if they have the decay lifetime, you get the cascade.
Yeah, that's more or less what I'm looking for experimental signatures of
an integral. I'll go back to my question about correlated functions, which is time independent thing again, but I don't want to go to long, such a long distance. That's all.
The long distance will be fine, I think. Yes.
Well,
yes. Oh yes. By the way, the long distance doesn't know anything about integrability. All it cares is speed of sound. I think so. Oh, short range at least.
Yeah. Not high momentum though. Never mind.
Yeah. So I mean, that's why I didn't have any transparent. I mean, it's not an open question, but the conjecture is that you can experimentally, empirically distinguish an integrable system from a non-integrable system. And one of the open questions for me, at least, is whether one dimensional Bose gas can thermalize on its own.
Well, it's related. If you give me the level spectra, I can immediately tell you whether it's integrable or not by looking at the correlations of the
energy levels.
There's various tests like that.
But can we observe that? For example, in the equation of state, the only thing you worry about is in fact the density of the energy levels. I mean, equation of state isn't really. But there could be more observable signatures because again, if you measure the equation of state. you won't see a difference between Poissonian and non-Poissonian statistics. Yeah, but for example, absence or presence of thermalization is a different.
That's a clear question.
Yeah.
If you would like to describe the thermalization by a kinetic equation, you will be deriving kinetic.
I won't get any dynamics at all.
Zero.
I will see zero. Yes.
It's the consequence of
yes.
Integrability.
Yes.
There will be no non-trivial kinetics.
Yes, what is the true answer? I mean, do I thermalize?
No.
At the level of the quantum kinetic equation, I see it. But is it really so?
Yeah, exactly. The absence.
And now, all right, okay, okay. Probably you know the answer on my next question. If I add a harmonic trap, will we thermalize or not? So now the system is not integrable.
I don't know.
Nobody knows. I mean, it's very interesting. So you take a Leibniz gas in a harmonic trap.
But you can write certain integrable systems in harmonic traps, like Calogero model.
Yeah. It's called Calogero Moser.
Yes. Calogero suzerain.
It's called Calogero Moser. It's unity divided by x squared plus tripping potential.
Yeah, that's called Calogero suzerain. How do you pronounce? Sutherland.
Yes, it's Sutherland. Moser,
yes. And that's what I mean. But,
Yeah, but this is the same Moser, yes. Yeah,
Maxim, a very simple example is take a triangle, yes, with certain angles and put particle there.
Yeah.
And this is the origin of quantum billiards.
And yes.
You get this quantum chaos problem, and then you get level statistics, and the statistics is intermediate, it's not Poissonian. Yes. And then, depending on the situation, using these statistics, you may find the correlation functions, and so on. And that's what.
No, my question is if I start, I have an integrable system. And I start from some state which is very far from the ground state, which is very far from thermal equilibrium, in the sense that one body, say I don't know, one body momentum distribution is not of a Maxwell-Boltzmann type at all. Will it thermalize eventually or not? By thermalizing, I mean you watch the one body density matrix. I mean, will it come to something like Maxwell-Boltzmann or not? And at the level of the kinetic equation, the answer is no.
No.
But is it really? And even if there is no thermalization, I mean, what happens if I spoil integrability slightly? If I add a harmonic trap, will it thermalize or not? Because I mean,
anyone has done any numerical calculations to this? I mean, suppose that very few
time dependent.
Very small system, maybe 10 particles. At least you can see sign. If it's integrable, don't thermalize, then you lock in certain mode distribution.
I think I
if it changes a lot, then at least it can tell you that it's going to go to.
So do you know the answer?
No,
I don't know. Okay. I don't know.
But it's the same question. Very simple. It's not only 1D. Take 3D spherical trap. Very simple.
Yeah.
Three-dimensional spherical trap. Then induce large oscillations of your Moser.
Yeah.
So it oscillates within the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. These are coherent.
Within the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, yes.
Absolutely so.
But already at the level of the kinetic equation, I mean, you dump everything.
Kinetic equations. What you do in the mean field, you generate excitations, yes? And if you write the kinetic equation, what you do is you say, my excitations are already described within the random phase approximation. And this is not even, and this is not initially true because that happened to the mother, the condensate.
Yeah.
What happens is that these excitations, they start interacting with each other because you produce them more and more, yes? They start interacting with each other, they separate from their mother, yes, and their behavior starts obeying sort of a kinetic equation.
Yep.
But what is interesting, it has been shown in people by Zaslavsky actually.
Yes.
That the true entropy is conserved. Yes.
Yes.
The true entropy is always conserved.
Yes.
well, unless there are some other things happening in the system. But in fact, they obey this Kalinic equation. And then what you can do, you can write down the Chirikov criterion of stochastic behavior.
Yes.
And then sort of chaotic behavior appears in the system.
That's our course. Yeah.
Yes, this is true. But what is interesting with all this chaos, that in nonlinear dynamical system, if you write a chaotic trajectory, always you can come back. Whatever chaos is there, stochastic, see whatever. Only if you start making observables, making averages over short
distances,
you lose
reversibility. Exactly.
And the problem becomes
exactly. Exactly.
But
in 1D, there is an additional detail that two particles with momenta k1 and k2 collide, and they exchange momenta, and the set of momenta remains the same. I mean, that's a very specific of 1D. So you wouldn't even if you were willing to write down a decent kinetic equation, I mean, you write it down and its solution is just zero.
But you believe
that the collisions you usually plug into your kinetic equation are binary collisions.
But not in 1D, because there is a conservation of energy and momentum. Binary collisions in 1D just.
No, but it's not. Okay. So you're saying that I have to add the three body collisions. I have to add the three body collisions because my answer with two body collisions doesn't make any sense. I mean, why don't I add the three body collisions in the three dimensional case?
Because in 3D, momentum is as a vector. It has three components.
No, I know.
So in 1D, you have two conservation laws, momentum and energy. And just you immediately see that the two momenta of colliding particles and the two momenta of producing particles will be just the same.
Yes.
There is no scattering. There is no kinetics.
Yes, I know, but I wouldn't like to adjust my approximation just because the previous one doesn't quite work. But your conjecture in Jorah's as well that the thermalization comes from the three body collisions, if anything, because I would rather say that in harmonic traps the thermalization comes from the fact that they are not quite plane waves. So I would expect that in a harmonic trap, the thermalization rate is suppressed as compared to a naive Boltzmann estimate with a small parameter, something like lambda or the de Broglie wavelengths associated with interactions over the Thomas Fermi radius of the cloud with some power. I don't know what, but I think to that degree, the thermalization will be suppressed in a harmonic trap. And also I would expect that with no harmonic trap in the free space, there is no thermalization at all. I mean, that's my current conjecture. But I don't really know.
Tell me the following. Take 1D particles on a finite line. Yes? This is exactly solvable. Yes?
With binary interactions,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, just leave linear model.
Yeah.
Put this 1D system in the excited state.
Okay.
Will it go to the ground state
eventually? Well, okay, let's...
A question. Just...
No, it will not go...
Just a second. And then induce extremely small perturbations.
Okay, yes.
And stop
yes.
disturbing the system.
Will
the system go to the ground state?
You mean will its one-body density matrix converge to something like Maxwell-Boltzmann law? I don't know. My conjecture is that no.
Even if I just make it...
Clear. Yes. You have to... even if you add noise, it won't thermalize. That's what I think. But it's an open question. And again, it's yet another link to something we got used to. All right. Okay. So let me quickly make the formal part. I could what? Ah. Why is it all black? And I was supposed to have some colors. No, no colors. All right, okay. This is violet. Yes. Right. Okay. Okay. So here what we do, we try to link what we know about the correlation functions of the one-dimensional gas to the measurement problems, to interferometry and so on and so forth, and what we do is harmonic tightly confining waveguides where the Liebig-Nigel model is the model, and we want to see how much interactions can spoil interference fringes. So to our understanding, the interactions play a dual role, and through either the first order correlation function, the psi dagger psi two different points, and the second order correlation function, which is just a diagonal two body correlation. So the first order correlation function leads to the suppression of the amplitude of the interference fringe for an infinite number of counts. So we assume that for an infinite number of counts we have some smooth line, that this smooth line is lower than for an ideal. Well, anything.
Okay,
all right. Yeah, anything. And this suppression, as Marvin explained, comes from the fact that when you perform an interference experiment, there is some finite width momentum distribution in your system, and different parts of the momentum distribution, they interfere differently, and when you add it up, the whole signal is suppressed. So on the other hand, the second order correlations that increase in the strongly correlated regime, they help the interference. They help to see interference fringes by suppressing the short noise. So meaning that if you have an interference pattern and you have a detector moving along this interference pattern, so for a fixed position of the detector, you detect how many particles go there. So you have strong interactions. Your system becomes closer to a melted crystal, and in a melted crystal, the noise in the number of particles within a given region is smaller than it would be for a system of free particles. From this point of view, the ideal interferometry would be with just the actual the actual crystal, where for any range you know exactly how many particles are there. But unfortunately, the first order correlations are completely lost there. So the conjecture is that there is probably some optimum, it's other way around. So between mean field and strongly correlated regime, there is a point where the interferometry is the worst place to do. So there is some very bad point between the weakly interacting and strongly interacting regime, where the fringes are maximally suppressed. Yep.
What are the squares in the experiment? Or what?
Well, it's just dropped them. But it is supposed to be a result of an inference experiment with a finite number of particles.
I
put them by hand. Yes, and in fact, an experimentalist would say that I couldn't have that because the short noise at zero should be suppressed. But yeah, I put them by hands. So in any case, and the goal is to optimize the interferometric process with respect to interactions to find bad regimes, good regimes, and so on and so forth. So what we interesting. All right. Yes. All right. Okay. So. But our. Well. And what we do, what we've done so far is that we found an approximate expression for the first order correlation function, and then optimized the interference experiment with respect to the suppression due to the first order correlations, and we didn't touch the second order yet. And I'm pretty sure, yeah, you must be very tired by now, but nevertheless, let me just briefly outline what we actually do when we don't talk to experimentalists. I mean, here I can explain what we actually do. So what we actually do is that we're interested in the short range expansion of the one body correlation function, which is the mean value of psi dag of psi. So keeping in mind that the long range scaling is known from Haldane theory, and thus we're hoping, but our final goal is to have a pocket calculator expression for the correlation function to make some estimates and so on and so forth. So contrary to the long range, there is nothing universal about the short range expansion. So it is very specific to the Lieb linear model. And what we got so far is the first three terms. Of the order of z square of the order of z is zero, and of the order of up to the order of zq, and all that is expressed through this Lieb linear e function, which is tabulated, known, and so on and so forth. And it's published, so you don't really need to make notes, but if you want to, I can tell something else. I'm just trying to see I told everything. Right. Okay. So a few words about how we get it. So we use several things. So we heavily use the singular properties of the singularities in the many body wave function. We use the known theorem from Fourier transform analysis that says that if you have a singularity of this kind, absolute value of to some power alpha, where alpha is not integer even, then when you Fourier transform this function, you will get in high momenta, you will get a dominant tail of this kind with a power with an exponential alpha plus one, and the third ingredient is the Hellman-Feynman theorem that Jor and Dima used to find the second order correlation function, so we use it for another purpose, so. The second term in the expansion is indeed very trivial. It is just the Hellman-Feynman theorem with respect to the mass. So you just, instead of differentiating with respect to the coupling constant, differentiate with respect to the mass. And in your Hamiltonian, I don't have it in the second quantized form. So in your Hamiltonian, this thing would just give the second derivative This term is just the second derivative of your correlation function. So you differentiate with respect to the mass, and you get the second derivative of the correlation function. So what is not trivial is A1 and A3. And let me just briefly outline what we do. So we derive a useful relationship between density matrices of different orders, and again, this relationship is very specific to the Lieb linear model. It could be generalized further, but in the way I presented it, it is very specific. So the statement deals with Taylor's expansions of the n-body correlation function, namely with the third term of the Taylor expansion, and it links it. It links the third term in the Taylor expansion of the n body correlation function to the n plus one body correlation function via this relation. So in particular, it gives a relationship between the third order term in the Taylor expansion of the first order correlation function to the second order correlation function. Again, Jora and Dima has obtained previously, and that's actually the reason for the success of this work. I mean, this chain relationship is very nice, but you have to interrupt it somewhere. And then, so thanks to Jora and Dima, it is interrupted at the second order level. So the brief, not even outline, but the essence of the proof. So the point is that when the easiest way to understand it is to go through the one-body momentum distribution. So when you compute the one-body momentum distribution, you can choose different orders of integrals. So if you choose an order, when you compute the Fourier transform of your many-body wave function first, and then trace over all other particles, so what you get is the following. So your many-body wave function psi has a singularity of a type absolute value of z. When you fully transform it to go to the momentum representation, you get 1 over k square according to this theorem. So if alpha equals to 1, and here you should have alpha plus 1, which is 2. You square it to when you compute the density matrix, you get 1 over k to the 4, and then the trace doesn't do much. Okay. So on the other hand, you can change the order of integrals. So you can trace over the all other coordinates first and obtain the one-body density matrix, and only then fully transform it. Okay. And now when you fully transform it, your conjecture would be that let's assume that there are terms of a type of absolute value of z and of a type absolute value of the z cube. So we go here. So we get 1 over k squared, and we get 1 over k to the 4 from cube. From cube, we get 1 over k to the 4 from linear, we get 1 over k squared. But then we compare it with another order of integrals. And we see that there is no any 1 over k to the 1 over k squared. That means that the first term in the Taylor expansion is just 0. And we can then get the prefactor, the constant from this thing, because rho 2 again is known from the previous work of yeah.
Considering the limit of large gamma.
No. We work at all densities at all. No. It's a full. It works everywhere. No. Again, since thanks to Jor and Dima, this rho 2 is known for all gammas. So another way to look at this relationship is to notice, and I found it much later to notice the following thing: that if you have a function of this kind, so absolute value of x minus x naught times absolute value of x plus x naught, times something slow, say times something with no singularities, if you integrate with respect to delta x, you can show that in your Taylor expansion, so the cubic term will have an absolute value on it, and you can see it just from on the symmetry grounds, and you can deduce the prefactor, no matter what kind of, and I forgot to put it. So here I also have some arbitrary non-singular function of x. So no matter what this function is, the third term is going to have this form, and the prefactor is known. So that's and this relationship is pretty useful, not only for this proof but for many others. So that's how we get all three terms, and you can see that each term is a challenge. So we desperately need the fourth one, but we need another challenge. It's not, there is no any systematic procedure.
Yep.
Yes. Oh yes, we compare that with Strong-Girardot expansion and we get an exact agreement. We converge to the wider traceful formula. Okay, corrected by Dima. Yes. Well, actually Dima doesn't go that far. No, we converge to Weidenfeld traces. There's no any mistakes in the short range expansion.
And it's Leonard.
Huh?
And it's Leonard.
It's a short range expansion. Okay, it's Leonard. Yeah, and in the Bogoliubov limit we also can converge to. By the way, I think I have a slide on one. No, I didn't take it. Oh yeah, we check the consistency. Let's see. Okay, so let me first show the consistency. Oh no. All right. Okay. So what I compare on this slide is in fact momentum distributions that stem from this cubic term. So as you could see in the momentum distribution, you have this 1 over p to the 4 tail, which comes from the absolute value cube singularity in the one body correlation function. So we know the prefactor and we plot it, we give it to experimentalists. David Weiss would probably measure this prefactor. I hope so. And everything is known there. And we compare this momentum distribution, which is this, again, cubic term in both limits. So in the Strong-Girardot limit, it converges to what's known. There's some pies and so on and so forth. And in the Bogoliubov limit, it also converges to the Bogoliubov. So we get it everywhere.
Yeah, I was just wondering naively.
Yes.
That for light gamma, you can probably express the result through the derivatives of fermionic green functions. Yes, and then the result comes out automatically.
That's what Dima does. Yeah.
Unity divided by gamma or something, it comes out, and after that there will be derivatives.
But I thought about it. But can he get the off-diagonal terms? And this his method is perfect for the diagonal parts of the density matrices. But off-diagonal, I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I have to look.
You simply work with Lieb-Linegger wave functions, and I guess that for short range it can be done.
Could be. But we've done that for all gammas, so there's no need. Okay, so as I said, this is 1 over p to the 4 tail is 1 over p to the 4 tail is indeed universal. So in a sense that it goes for short range bosons in all dimensions, and the idea is very simple. So if you have short range interactions, then the singularity in the wave function is always nothing else but the one body Green's function of the system, zero energy Green's function of the system. So it's an absolute value of z in 1D, log in 2D, and one over r in 3D. And when you fully transform this Green's function, you always get one over p square, and in the momentum distribution you square this Fourier transform and you get 1 over p to the 4. Can it be used for anything? I have no idea. At some stage I had some ideas of some kind of self consistent treatment, but I don't know. So far it's just a nice general statement, but pretty useful, pretty useless. So we use the terms we know, and it's not in fact enough for good accuracy. So we again, as I said, we know the first three terms of the tail expansion at zero. We know the scaling. So via Hallein's theory, we know the scaling at large distances with an unknown prefactor. And what we do is, and that's Vanya's invention. So what we do is we use a version, if you want, refinated to a purely mathematical method version of the renormalization group theory. First to deduce the value of the prefactor, and Vanya already gave a talk, and you saw that there's a pretty good agreement between um, uh, so between uh, in In case of known results, like in Tonton-Girardot, there is a good agreement, and we use this RG to connect these two regions, and again and predict prefactor as well. So if you compare these curves with Tonton-Girardot, where everything is known, so the accuracy, the number of terms we have so far, leads to an accuracy of about 15% in the correlation function. And to compare with the experiment, you would probably need slightly more. So we desperately need the next term in the correlation function of the Liebling-Jahr gas. If someone has any ideas, we will just we'll say thank you. But for estimates, those curves are not that bad. And now the last slide would be a nice slide, computer prepared slide. So would be the following. So I just take the existing experimental parameter. I just take the existing experimental parameters of David Weiss experiment at Penn State, and in fact they do it right now. And then I apply what's called the phase imprinting, and I thought I had a slide on phase imprinting, but I don't. So the idea of the phase imprinting is that you apply a very short and very intense standing wave. So it is so short that atoms don't have time to move. So the only thing that they have time to develop is the spatially dependent phase with no change in the density. And then you time propagate the state, and you start seeing interference fringes. So the oscillation in the phase of the one body wave function gets transformed to the oscillation in the density. And our question, and it is a baby version of an interference experiment. And now our question is how, by how much the first order correlations. So there's no second order correlations here. So we assume that we have an infinite number of particles. So there's no short noise. It is all just a systematic degradation of interference fringes. So we take a set of experimental parameters, which wasn't optimized in any sense. It is just the set of experimental parameters they used for their paper on Tonton-Girardot gases. And what we do is we mentally scan the density. So fix everything at the experimental parameters and scan the density. And what we see is, yes, there is certain degradation for the maximum degradation is of about 17%, but there is nothing signatory about it. So definitely worse regimes. But if someone had an idea of building an interferometer with this set of parameters, we would give our predictions for degradation. We would say that yes, okay, 17% degradation is not that bad. I mean, you still see the fringes, you still can measure something. Yes. Okay. So in this note, yes.
So the experiment is that you imprint the phase, and then
you imprint the phase. You imprint the phase. You wait for a certain time.
How much the
exactly? Exactly. And then, unfortunately, expand. So expansion. In fact, it adds a new twist. I mean, it makes it hard to interpret. So they don't observe the fringes in situ, and in fact they have to expand because the resolution is not that good. But generally speaking, that's what they do. Yes, they imprint the phase and don't wait for one recoil period. The recoil period is okay. It's a time associated with the recoil energy of the photon, and then the phase variation gets transformed to the spatial variation, and so generally the conclusion is that if you fix all parameters but density, and in fact that's what I think the actual experiments are going to vary. You would be interested in the capacity of your waveguide. Well, at a very low density where the short noise is bad, the degradation is small, and it's apparent. I mean, small, very small densities is almost no interactions at all. I mean, they're very, very far apart. At a very high density, you get the Bose condensate, where again there is no degradation. Even though we might think that the healing length becomes shorter in the Bose condensed regime, but it's not the healing length that defines the visibility. I mean, the visibility is defined by the half width, half maximum of the correlation function, and it scales in fact exponentially with one over gamma. The half width, half maximum of the correlation function increase exponentially as you go further and further to Bose condensates. Yeah, but somewhere in between there is a bad point, and our goal is to point out that don't go there. And on this note, let me finish. Yeah, let's. Yeah.
If you add a small finite temperature, what will happen to that last curve?
You'll tell me. I everything. You know everything about finite temperatures. Well, it will add. You will increase degradation, of course. Yes, and it will scale as well. You will lose fringes when the thermal de Broglie wavelengths reach the wavelengths of the beam splitter. With the thermal degradation, it's slightly easier to make estimates because it leads to the exponential tails. I mean, exponential tails, really. I mean, you have a size. It's all. I mean, exponential tails is almost a square dependence, and it's very sharp. And yes, I think as soon as your temperature exceeds. Exceeds the recoil energy for the beam splitter. Yes, you lose the fringes, so they will add up. And by the way, a general thought is that usually the loss of the first order coherence is considered to be a signature for appearance of strong correlations in the system, but the first order loss of interference fringes. Is considered to be a signature for appearance of strong correlations in the system. And if you look at the Hanover experiments and at Orsay experiments, and they lose the coherence, and they say and even the Morton-Seletic experiment again, you lose the first order coherence, and you say yes, we are in a strong correlative regime. But if you look at it, I mean, there are many ways how you can lose the coherence. I mean, you can get some noise in your apparatus. You can accidentally increase the temperature and so on and so forth. So what I think is that one should think about some other signature for the strong correlations, which could be the suppression of the short noise as you get to the strongly correlated regimes. So in other words, your atoms become more ordered. So for example, you take the Eric Cornell's experiment with vortices, and you detect atoms, and you compare the number of atoms to the left from the symmetry axis and to the right from the symmetry axis, and if you get strong correlations, you would probably see a suppression in fluctuation of the well, rather some integral of G2, yes. Not the G2 you are interested in. Not at the point.
Non-local.
Yeah, yeah. It would be a non-local G2, I think. So that's all right.